Good morning, and welcome to another in our series of mini shiurim on the book of Yehoshua. We are learning in the merit of the IDF, Israel's emergency services, the hostages, and the injured. And we are about to start Perek Tes. We are about to start Chapter 9. Just one concluding note on Chapter 8 from Professor Keel in the Dot Mikra edition of Sefer Yehoshua. He points out Yehoshua's decision to go to war against Ai. After going to war against Jericho, Yehoshua could have gone north, he could have gone south. Why did Yehoshua go west to Ai instead? And he reads here two motivations. One motivation is the military. If you think about the geography of Israel, you've got this central mountainous region that Yehoshua is encountering as you go west, or you can go north, or you can go south. What Yehoshua wants to do militarily is to split the north and the south so that they will not be able to band together. So he goes west to Ai so that the north and the south will be divided from each other. That will be relevant as we go forward because we are going to see the north unite. So Yehoshua could be heading this off. But I think really Professor Keel's major point is his second reason for doing so, which is to emulate Avraham, Masa Avos Simon Labanim, taking that idea that the deeds of the ancestors are a sign for their descendants, meaning, in this case, something for the descendants to emulate. So when Avraham and Sarah first come into Israel, they camp out Bein Beis El Uvein Ha'ai, between Beit El and Ai. So Yehoshua says, that's where I'm going first. That's the first place that I'm going to conquer, having entered and having fought Jericho. Okay. So that's just a note from Professor Keel. Our main focus today, though, is Perek Tes, Chapter 9. We are going to find out right here that what happens in Jericho, what happens in Ai, is known to all of the Canaanite tribes. Most of them are going to react by wanting to go to war. Not a huge surprise. However, there's going to be a population identified here as the Givonim, who are actually going to pursue peace with the Jews as a result of this. Not by coming to them and saying, wow, we're really impressed, we want to make peace. I mean, that will be part of the pitch. But they're going to trick the Jews into making a peace deal with them. That's where we are going with this. So, keep in mind where we've been, right? In chapter 8, they defeated Ai with a strategy that involved Hashem's assistance, as well as human effort. Hashem's role in it was very clear, given the contrast between what happened the first time they attacked Ai and the second, but they also had human strategy in the way that they lured the people of Ai out of the city. They made a statement for the Canaanites by destroying the city entirely, as well as the way that they treated the king. And they also, we're told, after that defeat of Ai, we're told that they set up an altar, they brought karbanos, they inscribed the Torah on stones. That event, as we said last time, might have happened after the defeat of Ai. It also might have been transplanted here in the book from other times. That was very much not clear. Okay, the state of the Jews at this stage, morale is high, God is with us, confident in Yehoshua's leadership again because he managed to right the ship after the first disastrous attack on Ai. He managed to identify the criminal and apparently set things right between the Jews and God. Okay, so let's start chapter 9. Chapter 9, sentences 1 and 2. International reaction, or intertribal reaction, I suppose you could say, within the land of Canaan and points west up to the Mediterranean. Vahi chishma kol hamalachim asher be'ever hayarden. When all of the kings who were west of the Jordan heard this, Bahar, Ubashfela, in the mountainous region, in the low-lying areas, Uvachol Chof Hayam HaGadol, all the way to the Mediterranean coast, El Mul HaLevanon, and up north as well, Hachiti, Vohe Amori, Aknani, Aprizi, Hachivi, Vayivusi, all of these different tribes, Chiti, Amori, Aknani, Prizi, Chivi, Yivusi, when they heard. It doesn't actually say what they heard. It just says when they heard. So Ralbach says, yeah, they heard about Jericho, they heard about Ai, and they know that they are in trouble. And that's certainly one school of thought. Abarbanel has a different school of thought. He says it's actually that they heard about the Mizbeach Yehoshua built and the recording of the Torah on stones. That's what they heard about. Why does that drive them to attack? So Abarbanel says Because Amru, they said, Halo be'emez zeu pal hamalachim ha'olchim lechbosh aratzos. Abarbanel says, that sort of thing is what kings do when they enter a land and they want to conquer it. This isn't the act of somebody who plans to just settle into some land on the shore of the Jordan. He means business. Now, Abarbanel could be drawing on two different things in saying that. Number one, he could be drawing on history. We know King Darius the Persian created the Behistun monument, this sort of a thing where you make a big public inscription and you say, I am here. But also, I think we said this last time as well on a different comment by Abarbanel. Abarbanel lives in the age of the explorers. Right? This is the end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th century, the Iberian Peninsula, and everybody is sending out their explorers to new lands and they're making their mark in the name of their religion. I wonder to what extent that influences Abarbanel's comment here. So either they heard about the conquest, and therefore, as we're going to see, all these tribes other than Givon joined together to attack the Jews. That's one option. Second option is Abarbanel. They heard about the Jews creating this monument, and they said, oh no, these Jews are really here to stay, and they're going to try to take everything, and we better attack them. And then you get Malbim with this counterintuitive approach. And Malbim says, no, they heard how the Jews defeated Ai. They heard this whole strategy of luring Ai out of the city and ambush and all of that. And they said, oh, they're like everybody else. They need strategies. They need strategies in order to beat Ai, you know, a city with 12,000 people in it. You know, we can band together and bring way, you know, more people, and then we will defeat them. So he says, Malbim says, that this actually encouraged the tribes to attack because they felt the Jews are vulnerable now. Very different way to look at this story. So what happens when they hear all of this? They banded together to fight with Yehoshua, the Im Yisrael, and with the Jews as a whole. Each one has an independent reputation. Yehoshua's reputation for his association with God and his miracles, his leadership, and the Jews as a whole. Pe'echod, as one, all of these tribes are going to attack. Again, you know, that Mikra said, that's why we're going in the middle, to try to prevent this kind of an alliance from happening. One other note here. Just that the chapter began with the words "Vayhi Chishmoa," when they heard. That's a phrase that we've seen before. When they heard, then dot dot dot. The beginning of chapter 5. I am just turning to it. Vayhi Chishmoa Komalcheho Amoria Shebeever Hayerdain dot dot dot. When all of the Amorite kings heard. Right. In that case, it was about the miracle of the drying up of the Yarden, of the Jordan. Again, in chapter 10, it's going to begin. Vayhi chishmo Adoni Tzedek melech Yerushalayim, kilachad Yehoshua zahai dat dat dat. Adoni Tzedek, king of Yerushalayim, hears about our conquests, and then the others hear about it, and so on. That's in chapter 10. And then in chapter 11, we get it as well. Chapter 11, sentence 1, after a major military victory by the Jews, Vayhi chishmo Yavin melech Chatzor, Vayishlach el Yovav, this king heard, he sent to another king. You know, is a refrain through the stages of conquest, and they heard, and then this, and they heard, and they did that. So I think that's for two reasons. Number one is to demonstrate cause and effect, right? This event X happened. The nations in Canaan heard about it, the tribes in Canaan heard about it, and then they reacted. And it's also, I think, to indicate the importance to us of the Canaanite reaction, of their reaction to divine miracles, of their respect for Yeshua and the Jews. So we're emphasizing our reputation is growing, the Canaanim are losing their morale. This is part of what Hashem is doing for us. Okay, so what's going to happen next is that the residents of Givon are going to try to trick the Jews into making peace. We're going to see that they're going to come to the Jews and pretend we are from far, far away. We are not local Canaanites, apparently believing that if they were Canaanites, they would not be able to make peace with the Jews. But if they're from far away, they would be able to make peace with the Jews. This is difficult. The Rambam writes in Hilchos Malachim, Perek Vav, Halacha Aleph, chapter 6, Halacha number 1, Ein osin milchama im adam ba'olam at shikarin lo shalom. You don't make peace with anybody, you don't make war, excuse me, with anybody until you first sue for peace. Echad Melchemes Harshus ve'echad Melchemes Mitzvah, whether it is a discretionary war or whether it is an obligatory war, doesn't make a difference. Shenemar, as the text says, Ki sikrav el ir lehilachem aleh v'karasa aleh l'shalom. When you draw near to a city to fight it, first you sue for peace. And he says, if they make peace and they accept the seven Noahide laws, we don't kill anybody, they will have to pay you tribute. That the Torah does say. But we do offer peace. So why are they going to try to trick us into a peace deal that they frankly could have had without any trouble? So we'll pick up with that with a few different explanations, God willing, tomorrow.